I'm Rebecca Vallis, and it's Galentine's Day, so I decided, that's right, I said Galentine's Day, not Valentine's Day, so I decided to celebrate properly as a single lady that I am, and to bring some friends to help me out. So to start off, Kate Bond, a good friend of mine, also a lady economist here at the Center for American Progress. Kate, hi.
Hey, how are you?
Happy Galentine's Day. But we should probably start by actually saying what Galentine's Day is. So to help us out, what is Galentine's Day?
Oh, it's only the best day of the year. As defined by Leslie Knope of Parks and Recreation, the great TV show. February 13th, my lady friends and I leave our husbands and our boyfriends at home. Or if we don't have any, we just go out and we kick it. We come and kick it breakfast style. Ladies celebrating ladies. It's like love fair minus the eggs plus frittatas.
We come and kick it breakfast style. Pretty freaking great, and the people in my life are are my lady friends, and they're amazing. And my man friends, I've had dude friends too. But, like, you guys are a huge part of why I love working at Gap. We haven't identified who all of you are with last names and positions and titles and such, but you guys all work at the Center for American Progress. And you're a huge part of why I love being here and why I have so much fun every day. Do you guys feel like that too?
Yeah, I totally agree. I mean, I think that is a frequent question. And, you know, sometimes the answer is, you know, like, I'm seeing someone and he's great and, you know, that's fine, but it's also not the totality of my life. And so I totally agree. I think that making sure, even if you are in a relationship, to make time for your friends and make time for the other relationships you have outside of your romantic relationship is really important. Especially because there are people, you know, I have friends in my life who've been my friends since I was 9 years old. You know, maintaining those relationships should be as important as whoever I'm dating at the moment.
I feel like even more important.
Yeah,
more important. Even more important. I'm like, Rebecca and I have talked about how we are very open to share our personal lives.
We're going next to
that. And so this is where I'm going to go. You know, I am divorced, and I was in a 10-year relationship. I was in a 10-year relationship, and I was married for the last 3 years of it. And my ex-husband walked out on me unexpectedly in this, like, cliche, laughing for, like, very simple young woman, and left his age-appropriate, challenging wife. I have no problem trash-talking him on the radio. My real relationships, and those were actually my chosen family. I'm not the person who became my legal chosen family for 3 years of my life, but it was truly my friendships. When it happened, my best friend since I was 5 was there within an hour. She was like, and I called her 7 a.m., so the fact that she was there in an hour was impressive. When I had to move suddenly, friends of mine paid for my movers. They came and they moved my apartment for me. Like, it just showed the strength of friendship to me in a way that, like, pointed to me that those are actually my soulmates. Like, these are the people who are my chosen family.
And this is, so I was joking about the fact that we can meet each other's Valentine's because you're single also. But as you said, that's not the main criterion. The main reason that I really wanted to do this with you, and you actually pitched it, and I should give you credit.
I think
we came up with it with this episode.
I think it's hard to work with it.
I am so pleasant.
Well, yes. Full clap for the idea. Thank you. Thank you, Audrey, for that. But you and I have talked about relationships over the time that we've known each other, and in part because we've both had really negative past relationship experiences that have, in many ways, reinforced how much we love and how much we treasure our chosen family and our friends. And I mean, I've had multiple relationships that have been incredibly unhealthy, that have resulted in me losing myself, doubting myself, spending all my time trying to fix another person and help another person be healthy. And it was really destructive to me while I was in it, but in a lot of ways made me stronger, right, to come out the other end, but also it made me appreciate all the more the people who helped me get through it, who were my friends, who were my family, who in many cases I didn't spend nearly enough time with when I was in those relationships because I lost myself and gave myself to it in a way where I ceased to be an independent person. And I say that as someone who identifies as a strong woman, right? But it was certainly the case for me as well. So this to me is, it's a day to celebrate.
Yeah,
it really is.
Mm-hmm. So Audrey, what's your deal?
So Valentine's Day for me is every single day.
Every single day.
I celebrate on it. I don't mean it that, like, creepy dude way where they're like, I love women. Like, those babies are like, we can be gross because I also love women.
Well, we can't get it.
So Valentine's Day to me, I mean, that's sort of like my whole MO in a lot of different ways. I think, I don't know, before, like, talking about our personal lives or whatever, like, I was raised by, like, a colony of, like, very strong women. And I, like, that's just, like, that is the space that I'm most comfortable in, and I think that's what I've sort of always gravitated to. And, like, that totally seeps its way into, like, my romantic relationships. And sort of the way that I see, like, the women I date. I think it's interesting coming at it from that vantage point. You know, I think sometimes we are socialized to, like, not see. We're trained to see other women as competition, or to be sort of like on edge with other women. And so being a feminist, being a lesbian, being like the product of like a very strong, tiny Mexican lady, I just don't see it that way. So I love Valentine's Day. I love it. And I think, you know, queer women have an interesting perspective on all of this because, and maybe this is just for me, I should only speak for myself, but I know that, like, with my strongest relationships and longest relationships, I've always been friends with that person. Like, it's always, like, you are in sisterhood with someone, and you are also in love with them. And so that's a very strong bond.
That's really beautiful. Thank you. Constance, you look like you have something to say.
No, I was just sitting here thinking when you were talking about chosen family, I feel like I speak to some of my, and I feel like, no, I know I speak to some of my girlfriends more than I speak to my family. Which, sorry, Mom. But I, like, that's just the nature of it, that when it comes to talking about things that are going on in my life, it's like I will easily text Audrey or Angela and be like, let me tell you what happened. Like, it doesn't necessarily have to be about men, because I find men to be annoying sometimes. But just generally anything that's going on in my life, at work, personal life, it's just easy that way. So I totally understand the chosen family thing. Most of my group chats are filled with women talking about a plethora of things. And I also love working with y'all, so when we can run through the halls when we find out Beyonce's pregnant.
Important day, indeed.
It really was.
And may they both be women.
Word.
Ooh.
I hate that. No, I don't. Yeah, no, just I agree with what everyone said. I've been here for almost 3 years, and some of the friendships I've made here have seen me through, you know, a breakup-ish, moving, ovarian cancer, and it's sort of incredible. You see these people every single day, and you never really know when you start out how they're going to impact you. But we are all sort of interwoven in each other's lives, and it's reassuring. I think, you know, Angela was saying, given the political climate, given just the climate of the world, it's very reassuring to see these really strong, hilarious women who also dance very well.
To kick off our Galentine's Day episode, right, we're joined by Moira Weigel. She's the author of Labor of Love, which looks at historical trends in dating and how dating can be work. Moira, thanks so much for joining the show.
Thanks for having me.
So I feel like when Kate and I were talking a little bit about what we wanted to ask you, we sort of felt the need to start with how you got interested in studying dating, but with an emphasis on how dating can really suck, something that she and I both feel and talk about a lot.
Yeah, I mean, you have a really good perspective on it. You bring up that it feels like a lot of work because it is a lot of work, and it sort of also replicates a lot of the work that we see in general in the economy that women face, where they do a lot of work and they don't necessarily get appreciated for that work. It's not really valued that much.
Yeah, well, I feel like the inspiration from the book came from a few different places, as these things probably always do. I feel like at one level, when I was first thinking about it, which is back in 2013, I guess, at this point, I feel like there were a lot of big news and magazine articles that were saying that dating is dead or dating is over. And I don't know if you guys, you know, if like your mom or your aunt or someone also sends you these articles, but I was getting a lot of them. And often I'd find that pieces that talked about the dating apocalypse or this idea that, you know, men don't ask women out to dinner anymore, were sort of implicitly about economic anxiety, were implicitly about how the recession was changing gender roles, how new technologies were changing gender roles and relations. So that was one starting point. It also struck me that, you know, I was doing a PhD at the time, I was teaching undergrads, and it struck me both among them and then just in the culture in general, how much of our language about dating is sort of filled with economic metaphors. So whether people are saying, you know, I'm on the market or off the market, or talking about a friend with benefit or playing hard to get, these are all economic ideas. So those sort of two things together make me think, what's the deal with this? And also, what is the history of this? Because, you know, like any historian, and also probably any single person at the time, I didn't want to believe that it was actually the case that romance was over forever.
Well, you know, so one of the things I'm struck by, and as you think about kind of the terms you just put that in, right, that that dating effectively, it either feels like it's part of the market or it's subject to market forces, maybe a little bit of both. It's hard for me to think about that without thinking about specific friends of mine who I will not name, but whom I would label as compulsive daters, people who and it's women for the most part, right, where it's, you know, going out 5 times a week with different people, feeling like they need to be you know, really working at it until they find that special person, and it starts to sound like the work that people do pounding the pavement to find a job or to get ahead at their organization.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that there are historical reasons for that, which we could get into, about where dating comes from and the first women who did it. But I also think it's sort of part of this broader phenomenon of how being online on our mobile digital devices all the time makes us feel like we should always be working and always socializing, and that there's always some opportunity that we might miss if we're not, you know, doing, if we're not checking our email or our Twitter right now. So I think that it's also part of this sort of 24/7 work culture that's also being felt in romantic and personal lives.
Could you also get into that? You sort of touched on it briefly, but how we ended up in this place where it ends up being a lot of work, and particularly a lot of work for women. Like, how did that historically develop?
Yeah, well, one thing that was really fascinating to me and made me want to write my book in the first place is that the history of this thing that we call dating, so this idea that, you know, young people go out in public for the most part and meet one another, and that you're supposed to go out and meet a stranger who you choose, who's going to be like your favorite person, who you also have sex with. This is like a totally weird idea of courtship, right? If you look at most of human history, like in most places, if you think of, you know, whether it's like the Jane Austen scenario of a woman sitting in her parlor, or if it's like coming of age in Samoa, you know, the Margaret Mead monograph about courtship in the South Pacific. These are very, very, very different courtship systems. The idea that what you should do is go out to a bar and find your favorite person there is totally new. And that historical development completely coincides with women entering the workforce, right? With women starting to work outside private homes, whether it's their home or homes where they were slaves or maids. Women for most of history had been mostly inside homes and private places. And it's when women start taking paying jobs outside the home, and they get a lot of young people moving to cities around 1900, that you start to have this practice that people call dating or making a date, where young people go out and meet on their own without their parents there, without like a priest or a rabbi or whomever. And that, so the origins of dating, this way that we, you know, our society counts on for people to find one another, is deeply tied to the history of women entering the workforce.
And take us through the trends. I mean, your book surveys all the way back to the early 20th century, but it helps tell the story of how much has changed over those years. So give us some context. It hasn't always looked like it does today with Tinder or Bumble or going to a bar.
One of the things that was fascinating to me is that dating starts out around 1900, as you said, as this sort of working class invention. So it's women who are working in small factories, or working as waitresses or sales ladies in American cities in the 1900s and 1910s, who first start doing this thing they call dating, so going out and meeting men on their own. And at first, the authorities think that this is very scandalous. You know, there was no context earlier where a young woman would go meet a young man who would buy something for her, like a meal or a drink, other than prostitution. And a lot of the first working women who dated were ended up arrested for it, or harassed by the police, or sent off to these sort of reform schools. See, from the beginning, this sort of what we would probably now think of as the most cornily traditional looking date, like a man buying a woman at dinner, was thought to be really, really scandalous and a cause of real concern. And then for various reasons over, so from the 19-teens through 1920s, that practice gets more and more normalized, and it goes from being something that relatively poor or immigrant women do in cities to being something that middle-class women who go to college do that seems sort of glamorous. So yeah, that's sort of stage one of the history.
You're bringing up something interesting, too, about how dating is different for different people in different class levels. You talk also about how dating costs a lot of money. Women spend a lot of time prepping and getting dolled up for a date, and there's a lot of money associated with that to be able to go to nice places. So how does someone's different economic position affect how they date in the modern era, but also through history?
Well, it has a huge effect, and it's very interesting to me, as I mentioned, that it sort of starts out as this working class invention that's pioneered by women who are in cities, either don't have families around or don't have fancy Jane Austen style houses where someone can like visit them in their living rooms. They have to go out and do their own thing. Often these women can't afford hot meals, and that's part of why they go out and make dates with men, because then as now, and more so then than now, men are earning a lot more money than women for the same work. Then dating gets kind of picked up by upper middle to upper class kids who are going to college in the 1920s and think it's kind of glamorous, and you start seeing this culture of parties and going out, petting, which is basically, I would argue, just hooking up. But in the 1920s, they call it petting. And it's really in the middle of the 20th century that it becomes middle class. But anyway, it's very tied to people's socioeconomic levels. I think in ways that are, some ways that are obvious, you know, it's like how much money can you spend on dinner, but also ways that are less obvious, like, you know, when we look at how schools sort people according to class, it still serves some of the functions that in earlier eras were associated with families, you know, arranging marriages or setting you up. And it's hard to even measure where the, I mean, as anyone who dates knows, it's hard to measure where the boundaries of that work of dating or the cost of dating end. Like, you know, I think there's a whole makeup industry, cosmetic industry, exercise industry, all sorts of things that you could argue are tied to dating and people's desire to sort of seem desirable.
Yeah, and there's also, I think, something that even goes sort of deeper than this, the ways in which sort of opposite-sex heterosexual dating reinforces some of these economic inequalities as well, particularly between men and women. This is something I brought up when I was lucky to see you speak in D.C. when you were on a book tour, and I went on some long, rambling sort of rant about sort of my own history, where I had been in one really long-term relationship, kind of, you know, similar to you. I was writing my dissertation, but I was in this one long-term relationship where I ended up in a really economically precarious position because I was prioritizing my male partner's career and not working, and sort of all these things that were reinforced by social gender norms, where I was ended up being really sort of left high and dry when that relationship ended. So there's a lot of ways in which women spend a lot of time dating. They maybe let men pay for them. They maybe want to seek out higher earning partners, but they're actually limiting their own economic opportunities since they're constraining themselves. So I was wondering sort of your thoughts on that, the ways in which dating can even sort of reinforce economic inequality between the sexes.
Yeah, I think that it does that in a couple different ways, because I think, you know, you asked at the beginning why I wanted to write this book about dating. Part of it was also that I think I'm really interested in gender roles. You know, I wasn't obsessed with dating advice or anything before I started researching it, but I was really interested in how dating becomes this theater where straight people rehearse gender roles. So it's like, here's how a man's supposed to be. Here's how a woman's supposed to be. And I think, of course, I don't really believe that anyone should be any one way because of their gender. But I think that what you're talking about, this idea of certain kinds of romantic relationships reinforcing sort of quote-unquote traditional gender roles that might actually really disadvantage women, is a huge thing in dating that we see throughout its history. And I think, you know, this manifests in different ways, but all kinds of dating advice that said, you know, you shouldn't be too aggressive if you're a woman dating, you should play down your sort of professional accomplishments and aspirations, those to be desirable. Those are certainly aspects of dating that can leave women in a precarious position. It's also really interesting to see how these patterns stratify by class, because increasingly among colleges, Americans without college degrees, courtship patterns are changing. As I'm sure you guys are aware, you know, marriage is becoming much and much less common. Childbearing outside of marriage is more common. So this idea that, let's see, that dating is supposed to lead to a certain kind of marriage partnership seems to have to be really disappearing among certain Americans. So it's very class stratified.
In what ways can female friendships across the income spectrum take on a lot of the support role that relationships have in the past?
I think they absolutely can, and I talk about this at the end of my book, feeling that, like, loving female friendships, it's really, are sort of historically have been undervalued, you know, in favor of this fantasy of heterosexual romantic love, and that they can absolutely play a really important and rich role in our lives. And we're definitely seeing that. I mean, statistically speaking, I do think that professional women are still much more likely to end up straight married to a man who makes more money than they do than working class women. But I do think we're seeing culturally a big shift towards marriage no longer being a norm. You know, I think it's what a majority of adult women are not married. I think since Rebecca Traister's book is about this, I forget what year it is. It's like 2012 or something that we crossed the line. And we're seeing more and more pop culture representations of female friendship too. I always think about the difference between Sex and the City, which was on TV when I was a kid, and, you know, Broad City and Girls, and even Insecure, I'd say too now, that it's like these are TV shows where there are romantic relationships, but the central emotional drama is about female friendships. unlike, I think, the Sex and the City model, where it was all about, like, who was dating who and how long was it going to take to get married to Mr. Big. So I do think that in the culture, there definitely seems to be a lot more validation and emphasis placed on women friends supporting one another, both professionally and personally.
Yeah, I love this trend. Me and my best friend of 27 years, we're trying to figure out a way to sort of formalize this model, so we now split our Netflix and Hulu accounts.
Yeah.
She's the beneficiary of my retirement accounts if I die, so if anything happens, maybe I'll know who to talk to.
Well, and hearing you mention Sex in the City, right, I because I'm feeling old lately, I realized, so I started rewatching Sex in the City from season one for the first time since I had watched it when it was airing, and I realized it had been 17 years since I discovered Sex in the City, and then I realized I'm their age in season one.
Oh, wow.
And it was sort of mind-blowing because I went, this really still actually is all true and looks a heck of a lot like my life. But I, you know, I think the female friendship being a huge piece of it.
Yeah.
No, that's true. Maybe I'm being unfair to Sex and the City because I do think that it is that show in a way. It's like we think superficially it looks like a fantasy about clothes and men and shoes, but it's actually a fantasy about, like, adult friends who still have time to hang out all the time.
Yeah, exactly, especially in your 30s. We're both in our 30s and single, so we know that it's important that, like, we aren't that typical model of suburban wife with children who spends her whole time with their family. We are women in our 30s who are spending time with each other.
Just with fewer pairs of shoes.
Yeah, nobody is. I mean, that's the other thing. I feel like so many of us, and I totally include myself in this, feel kind of tyrannized or judged by certain ideas about what's quote-unquote traditional at some points. And I think that it is really encouraging to see all these other models of ways to live, which actually are much more normal, statistically speaking, are much more common than the quote-unquote traditional would be. So that I think, yeah, it's exciting. It's cool about the retirement account, too. I feel like it's funny in America, and God knows what will happen now, but in America, marriage is still so prioritized legally, and there's so many benefits and privileges that you have to be married to get access to, which is not the case in, you know, Canada or Western Europe. There are other changes at a structural level or systemic level that could make friendships, you know, deprioritize marriage, but it's cool that you have that your friend's the beneficiary of your retirement account. Yeah. It's like a personal good start, it seems like.
Moira Weigel is the author of Labor of Love, which is a historical survey of dating trends in the United States. Moira, thanks so much for joining us for Galentine's Day, and happy Galentine's Day to you.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Welcome back to Talk Poverty Radio on the We Act Radio Network and the Progressive Voices Network. I'm Rebecca Vallis.
And I'm Kate Bond. And here with us is Judith Keegan-Gardner, who is a professor emerita at University of Illinois Chicago, as well as an editor of the journal Feminist Studies. And she just recently edited a volume on women's friendships.
Professor Gardner, thank you
Glad
so much
you.
For joining the show. So we're excited to bring you into this conversation as really an expert and a scholar on female friendships. Just to kick us off, I mean, give us a sense, as you've studied the subject, how have female friendships changed over time, both in practice and in how they're represented, say, in literature?
Well, probably there's been more change in the way people think about women's friendships than the real thing, but sometimes it might be the reverse. That is, the stereotypes are that women are catty and not good friends to one another. I've seen cartoons, for example, where women are sitting together face to face and they're saying things like, oh, I love you so much, you're my good friends, we're friends forever, and the caption says, lasts 2 years. And then it shows a picture of young men sitting side to side on a couch with controllers in their hands playing video games, and they're calling each other names, you bitch, you fool, etc. And it's the caption is, their friendships last a lifetime. And this is a popular version of friendships. We see some of this in a lot of current television and other representations of men's and women's friendships. I like to contrast the film Bridesmaids, for example, with The Hangover or other male buddy films. And the male buddies don't seem as engaged with one another. They have tricks or fights with one another, but they end up as, they start as buddies and they end as buddies. The women are assumed to have more competition in their friendships, more emotional outbursts, more bust-ups and get-together, etc. I don't know that this is actually true, and a lot of the friendship literature and even scholarship is based on some slices of the population that are not everybody. That is, advice literature for how to find new friends, for example. There have been a batch of those books recently. And they tend to focus on white middle-class women fairly young. I'm thinking of, for example, of Rachel Birchie's MWF Seeking BFF, explicitly race designated, if not class, a white woman singing seeking best friend forever, or Andrea Bonior's book The Friendship Fix. These are advice books for women on how to find friends, and the implication is you may need an advice book for how to find friends, just as you need an advice book for how to find Mr. Right or who to date, or advice books on how to get that job you want, etc. And in this recent literature, finding friends is sometimes described as a challenging task. And what we know about the reality is somewhat mixed. There are not only more single people now, but there appear to be more lonely old people. In general, women who are partnered with men tend to outlive the men, so there are more single women, more widows and divorcees than the reverse. And on the other hand, of single old men, they appear to be lonelier. The statistics and studies show that women alone keep social skills frequently of finding other women, joining church groups or other groups where they will find themselves useful and have things to do. Fewer old women become grouchy alcoholics living by themselves.
Yeah, maybe not a woman in D.C. right now.
Fair.
But
speaking from personal experience.
Yeah, so I'm really interested in this exact thing, the ways in which women maintain their social skills, maintain their female friendships, and how it might affect sort of the rest of their lives. So, you know, I think of maybe something akin to a non-traditional family structure and how we know that traditional partnered families have certain positive outcomes, like they have better economic outcomes, they have longevity outcomes, but whether female friendships can sort of fill a role in supporting women in enhancing their economic independence, perhaps, if they have this sort of support system and emotional intimacy from friendships, as well as maybe helping women increase their political power if they feel some sort of like broad solidarity for women's issues that is fostered by their female friendships.
Well, I think this can go both ways. I was in Washington, D.C. recently for the Women's March, and it was a huge number, 500,000 women, talking about the issues that we care about, a lot of women wearing pink hats, and speaking up for a perspective that will continue, I hope and think, to fight against a backlash which is not the mainstream in our country, but it's definitely in power now, a backlash against women's reproductive rights, against women's occupational advancement. So a lot of pushback from recent years in a very negative direction, and then resistance to that pushback. And right now, we're just in the beginning of seeing how this battle will shape up. I personally think if one just looks at the demographics and one looks at the ideologies of recent years, I do not think our society wants to go back to a very old-fashioned view of what women are and what women can do. So that pushback and resistance is going to compete. On the other hand, recent events have shown some people that the glass ceiling for women's advancement is in some respects still a pretty tough barrier. And one can argue about when and whether the United States is ready for a female president, for example, and more people in this country thought we ought to have one than the person who is now president. But things did turn out in a what feels like a reactionary, a backward-looking way. And this thinking about women's friendships, friendship is a very interesting thing to think about and to study. On the one hand, it seems to be one of the freest of all relationships. And older views on friendship emphasize this, that you don't choose your parents, you don't choose your children primarily, but you do and can choose your friends. But that utopian way of looking at friendship, it's true, but it's also true that people tend to pick people who are pretty much just like them. This is called homophily, or friendship of the same. And people can form friendships across class lines, but there's also a lot of factors that make people not so comfortable if they don't feel they are the same ethnicity, the same class background, the same cultural background as their friends. A lot of the advice columns are laden with people writing in about things like, I go out to dinner and so-and-so, I go out to dinner with my friends, but they always assume that I'll pick up the tab or something like that. A lot of resentment, clearly, and a lot of confusion, because we have a set of ideas about equality, and people aren't equal, and in all these situations, one person is likely to have more cultural competence or just more cash than the people that she is with. And this creates a certain amount of friction. In looking at these advice columns, and I today just looked up a few recent ones. Somebody in the Huffington Post, for example, saying, here's why friendship and money don't mix. Money issues strain friendships. Once money changes hands, your relationship becomes strictly business. And that column provides a way out when the Lauren Bowling, the writer, says, gifts, however, fit wonderfully within any relationship. Mm-hmm. In other words, she advises not expecting everything to be equal, being willing to give more than you receive, and that lightens up the load, decreases the resentment of people feeling like, oh, I did such and such for someone and they didn't pay me back. And the ideal of friendship then is supposed to be one where you do things for the good of the other person as well as yourself without feeling you need a tit for tat tallying of the results. But in fact, as I said, people are more comfortable when things seem to be equivalent, if not absolutely equal, and that, besides people's opportunities, tends to keep people in relationships pretty much with people like themselves. One of the obvious things, if we were talking about friendship and money, is if you have a lot of money, you can do all sorts of things, fun leisure activities. You can do things with your family, but you can do things with your friends. If you hear about friends, oh, I'm taking my bridesmaids to Hawaii for the weekend before the wedding, that sort of thing. One hears about these things in newspapers and sometimes in real life. And obviously the person with plenty of money to spare has more freedom to use that in helping friends, but also in just enjoying what friendship may mean. For working class and poorer people, a lot of friendship is expressed in reciprocal obligations, reciprocal activities. That is, many women, particularly, but not exclusively single women, trade babysitting with one another.
Mm-hmm.
And the care of children is something that's traditionally, it can be very isolating. The Betty Friedan talked about the isolated suburban housewife if she's all alone in her house with a couple of little kids. But most of the young mothers I know get out to the playground, do some socializing with other young mothers. So in that cohort, it's obvious that people can both support one another and share when they're in the very similar situation. If you've got a two-year-old, somebody else who has a two-year-old is going through very similar issues that you can talk about, that you can just trade, but that you can support each other when one person says, hey, can you watch little Willie or whoever it is while I run to the store? Will you pick little Lois up, et cetera? So at different life stages, friendship may mean different kinds of activities for people and may build on different sorts of connections.
We've been speaking with Judith Keegan-Gardner. She's a professor and a scholar who has studied female friendships and actually recently edited a journal on the subject. Professor Gardner, thank you so much for joining Talk Poverty Radio, and happy Galentine's Day to you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah. Take care.
Bye.
You're listening to Talk Poverty Radio on the WEACT Radio Network and the Progressive Voices Network. Continuing our episode for Galentine's Day, this is Rebecca Vallis.
And this is Kate Bond.
And we are extremely pleased to have with us, joining by phone from Philadelphia, the city that still has my heart, Angela Nike and Tiana Gaines Turner. They are both members of Witnesses to Hunger, which is an amazing group that really puts a lot of what we've been talking about this week into practice, bringing mothers together as partners in activism. Nike and Tiana, thank you so much for joining the show.
Thank you for having us.
So just to kind of kick us off, Tiana, do you want to tell us a little bit about Witnesses to Hunger for folks who might not be familiar with it, and who you guys are? Who are the witnesses?
Well, Witnesses to Hunger is an organization that was created in 2008 by Dr. Mariana Chilton. And we use our photos to inform policymakers, federal, local, and state government, in the importance around hunger and poverty. We testify in front of Congress. We do articles in the newspaper. We do some work with MSNBC, the Daily News. And we basically just help people to understand that, you know, poverty and hunger is something that you cannot talk about without talking about depression, safe and affordable housing, education, you know, nutrition, all of those different things. So We're an organization that's growing, and we are a sisterhood, and, you know, I'll let Nike say a little bit more.
You kind of covered everything. Basically, we are the voice for the people that feel voiceless. We try to empower people and give people their voice back. We try to make people understand that nobody chooses to be in poverty, that poverty is the hand that we are dealt. And a lot of times in society, they look down upon people that are impoverished or live in poverty. And unfortunately, we need to change the stigma on what poverty really looks like.
And you guys get a lot of attention and well-deserved attention for really being the real experts on poverty and on hunger and all the issues that you both just walked through. But one of the things that maybe you don't get a lot of chances to talk about is that sisterhood that Tiana was just referring to. So as we're, you know, talking about female friendship this week and Galentine's Day and what women do for women, tell us a little bit about that sisterhood and why that matters to you guys. And Tiana, we'll start with you.
It matters a lot because, you know, sometimes when you're going through so much and you've been through so many different challenges in your life, it's good to know that you're not alone. Sometimes, unfortunately, you can't turn to family, you know, for different reasons. So it's good that I can pick up the phone and call Nike, or we can meet at a meeting and I can just, you know, unload some of my frustrations, and she understands what I'm going through. She doesn't judge me. She gives me encouragement spiritually as well as a sister. And, you know, she lifts me up as well as I lift her up and our other sisters. So, you know, it's important to be able to talk to someone who knows the voice of the people, but also is the people. And that doesn't, you know, come as a judgment.
Nike, anything you want to add there either?
Yes, I think that the strength of us is the fact that we're unified. Even though we have come from different backgrounds, different nationalities, a lot of us have the same struggle but different devils. Somebody might have problems with housing and domestic abuse, while somebody else might have problems with health insurance and their children being sickly. So what happens is when one is down, the other one is the other one's strength. A lot of times what we do is we encourage each other. Sometimes, like Tiana said, we can't go to family members or others because they'll judge us. But one thing I love about us, no matter what we go through, we stick together. And we can rely on one another to encourage each other and keep us uplifted because we got enough people attacking us on the outside. So we try to keep it real close and knit on the inside and keep fighting a good fight because we already go through adversities every day, just trying to make it to the next day. And if you don't have a good support system, a lot of times you stop fighting. You don't have no more strength, but we give each other strength and power.
Yeah, I love this. I love this idea of being stronger together as women, as female friends. And one thing we're sort of thinking about on our Galentine's Day episode is the power of women friends doing activist work together and how it is really sort of doing this together is what makes sort of female-led activism so strong. So how does, you know, your friendships with each other and your support networks with each other help the work that you guys are doing in your communities?
Well, I know for me, it helps us because we are unified. It gives us more power when you come together and it's not just one person, it's several people that come together and uplift their voice and speak about the injustice that's done. And talk about a lot of things that a lot of people are afraid to talk about, whether they're scared DHS might take their children because they think they're unfit when it's just the fact they just don't have the income to take care of their children, but they are in a well-loved home, to domestic violence when that is the breadwinner and all you got is that individual to take care of you. So with us coming together, it makes a more impact. It makes us stronger. It makes our voice louder. And it encourages other people to stand up for what's right, to do what morally is right, the right thing to do. So I love the fact that we do advocacy work together because everybody has a different issue, but it's one big issue, and that's to eradicate poverty.
That is so true. And, you know, just to echo what my sister said, you know,
sometimes to stand up in front of people and tell your story, and sometimes for you to be able to get in deep down into the nitty gritty of what you did, is traumatizing, because you're bringing up some old wounds, you're going through the situation, you're living in the situation, you know, and for you to stand up and speak out and tell somebody what you're going through, and then some of your family found out, your friends, your children's classmates, you know, it's important to have somebody standing there behind you that you know that really has your best interest, that has your back, and that's encouraging, you know, while you're speaking, and also lifting you up before you go on that stage, because when you're on that stage and you're in front of that microphone, or you're sitting there, you know, when you're sitting in front of a congressperson and they're talking down to you, you have to have a strategy. You have to be able to not let people bait you into being that angry woman, or, you know, bait you into an argument. And sometimes that gets really hard when you're trying to speak to people and help them to understand, and they're being ignorant, nasty, rude. They're putting words in your mouth. They twist what you say. You know, so it's always good to have, you know, the support and have somebody there beside you the whole time.
So the activism that you guys are engaged in day in and day out, in addition to the photographs that you mentioned, but as you've just been describing now, is really it is about telling your story and sharing your family's story in a way that can help push back against the myths about what poverty and hunger looks like, and pushing back against that stigma that as you guys have said so eloquently, is incredibly backwards and not well deserved. Deserved at all. Are there specific examples that either of you want to share about times that have been particularly hard doing this kind of work, which really is very emotional work, but that because you had the sisterhood of the witnesses, you were able to continue to do it?
Well, for me, I never forget, you know, the first time that I did my article and I spoke out in regards to, you know, my own challenges as far as being homeless twice, having three kids, you know, disabilities, having disabilities myself, running out of food. And people was chiming in, you know, writing to the newspaper, and they was calling me stuff like, oh, well, how can she live in poverty and she's a 200-pound fatty? You know, or she needs to be neutered as if I was an animal or a cat. And it hurt my feelings, and I really wanted to type back in some real nasty type of things. But I remember, you know, one of my sisters, you know, was just basically saying, you know that that's not true, and you know that that's not who you are. So don't give them power by feeding into the ignorance. You know, and if I'm not mistaken, I think it was Nike saying, you know, don't feed into that, because you know that's not who you are. And, you know, when you give in, they got you. You know, and at the time I needed to hear that, because they was attacking me and they were saying some really nasty things about me and my family. It's always easy for people to judge us because they don't know what we go through. But to walk in our shoes, it's a total different walk. It's a total different battle.
Yeah, same question to you, Nike.
With my situation is, because I am a survivor of gun violence, because I got shot at 14 and I was raped by my dad at 15, 16. It was a lot of, and from family members feeling like ashamed. However, I knew that my pain had a purpose, and my purpose is to help somebody else to be encouraged that you can still do it, and to teach people that all the stereotypes are not true. Just because somebody's disabled or living in poverty, they're not lazy. We're not walking incubators. We do want things. We're very highly intellectual, and we just want the same opportunities as somebody else. And when you stand up there and tell your story, people tend to look down upon you. And that's one thing I love about our sisterhood, because usually we're never by ourselves. It's somebody, whether it be another sister or staff member, with us to give us that encouragement when that speech gets hard, or when you're telling your story and it opens up the traumatic wounds. Like, I suffer from PTSD. A lot of times what triggers it is me having to go and relive it. When you tell your story, you relive it. Even if you over it, you still relive it. And the problem is that we want solutions. We don't want a handout. We want a hand in. We want help. Teach us how to fish. Don't give us a fish. But don't knock us down when we try to fish. So, with that being said, I think it's just the pain of reliving every story. But we know that we have to do it, because if nobody else would do it, it's not easy work. And if it was easy, everybody else would do it. However, we was chosen for this. This is what we do. And the Philadelphia Witnesses and all the other witnesses from around, we support each other. And no matter how hard the story is, we don't judge each other, because we know that we were just dealt the cards and we're playing the hand again.
Yeah, mm-hmm. your stories are just so powerful. It's really great to hear sort of the depth of your friendship and how it really does help you do this really, really hard work that, you know, may not be possible if you didn't have this strong sisterhood. And you guys are all also mothers, which I think is really important, sort of female friends as mothers working together. When you all have children, you also need to care for. And, you know, I think you are probably acutely aware of the inadequacy of our childcare system in this country. Could you talk a little bit about how sort of being friends as well as being mothers helps address some of those shortfalls for the provision of childcare?
Well, it is definitely difficult. I'm going to speak as far as having three children with medical disabilities. It's very difficult because, for one, I can't trust everybody to watch my kids because my children have epilepsy. So everybody doesn't know what to do when a child has a seizure. Automatically, you will panic, and I understand that. That's just human nature. But it's also really hard to find a child care provider that will be willing to take and care for my kids because of the disabilities. And then also understand that, yes, I do work, but I don't have astronomical amount of money to pay for you to watch my kids. You know, so it's like basically a double for me, because, you know, I have to rely on sometimes my sisters or my friends or, you know, someone that I can, you know, has actually went through the training to know how to deal with a child with epilepsy and asthma, because it's very difficult, you know. So I feel like we need better laws that support mothers as well as fathers, because we have a lot of single fathers out here that is doing an excellent job in trying to raise their children. And let's just be honest, right now with the economics that's going on and with our new presidency and different things that's going on, is the light is looking a little dim for some of us. But with Witnesses to Hunger and our sisterhood, we always try to make sure that we keep that light burning, you know, strong. And we know that we're up against some tough times, but together we will continue this fight.
Well, Angela Nike and Tiana Gaines-Turner, two members of Witnesses to Hunger in Philly, it's been wonderful speaking with both of you, and hope to have you sisters back on the show soon.
Yeah, thank you so much.
And happy Galentine's Day. And that's the show. Thanks for listening to Talk Poverty Radio on the We Act Radio Network and the Progressive Voices Network. You can find us anytime at www.talkpoverty.org/podcast, where we have a full archive of all past shows. You can also listen to us anytime as a podcast on iTunes. And send us your pitches to info@talkpoverty.org. Thanks for listening.
I work and get paid like minimum wage. Sights to hit the clock by the end of the day. Hop from downtown into the hood where I stay. The only place I can't afford, cause my block ain't safe. I spend most of my time working, trying to bring in the dough. And none of those could connect me with the HMO.